God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change,
the courage to change the things I can,
and the wisdom to know the difference.
Just one.
The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anyone here in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you. So please just feel free to unmute and introduce yourself. All right. The preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous says that Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. I'm coming to you guys tonight from the Outer Banks of North Carolina, family vacation. It's kind of fun, but I'm on new equipment, so I may close the meeting by accident. So the format of this meeting is an open speaker ask it basket. Tonight, we are very excited to have Sarah from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, come and tell her story. After she tells her story, we'll then take a short break around the top of the hour. We'll call for announcements, Path to Seven Tradition Basket, et cetera, give Sarah a break. And then we'll reconvene for the last 25 minutes of the meeting or so, and we'll ask her questions. And the questions that we ask are the questions that you submit. So if you look in your participants window, you'll see a user called questions with a red question mark. That's really Larry. So as you think of questions, please feel free to chat those, and we will ask Sarah when the time comes. We don't have any canned questions, so we're going to ask her the questions that you send in. So I'm super excited. Sarah is highly recommended. You can thank Chris S. for this. I don't want to take up another minute of your time. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you so much. Hi, everyone. I'm Sarah. I'm an alcoholic. And, at first, I want to start off by thanking the group for allowing me to be in service tonight and allowing me to share a little bit of myself and my story with you. It's always truly an honor to show up for Alcoholics Anonymous in any way that I'm able to. And because I owe Alcoholics Anonymous a debt that I could never repay, for the life that I get to live today as a result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and the work I do here. And it's truly a miracle. It's been a really beautiful weekend, and happy Easter to anyone who celebrates. And, I just came back from spending time with my family, and, an experience that for me used to be one of absolute utter chaos, fear, confusion, anxiety, anger, rage, resentment. It has now become a beautiful experience where I get to be in service to my family, where I get to connect with family members, that I get to experience love and connection, because the 12 steps taught me how to get out of my own way. They taught me how to see the truth, and they helped me change my perception of reality. And, because I didn't know for a really long time that my perception of reality was completely flawed, and that when I picked up a drink, that alcohol shifted my perception of reality, and that I used alcohol for a very, very long time to fix what was wrong with me internally. I have an amazing family. They're incredible human beings. And that isn't the story I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with. I had a litany of terrible, awful things that these people had done to me, not just my family, but everybody in the world around me, because I love being the victim, and my perception of reality is one that everybody hates me, and that I don't fit, and that I don't belong. And, as a result of having an experience with the 12 steps and having this shift of perception and being given this new set of glasses, I get to see my family for who they are today, these amazing, loving people. And that's a gift that I can't put into words what that means to me, and how beautiful that is for me. So, I have my daughter downstairs right now, a relationship that was also restored as a direct result of the work done in Alcoholics Anonymous, who's, downstairs online studying for law school, and, the miracles I get to witness on a daily basis, because my life today is a miracle. I'm not saying that I'm a miracle personally. I'm saying that I've experienced miracles in Alcoholics Anonymous because I was a hopeless, helpless, hopeless variety alcoholic. I couldn't breathe a sober breath for several decades. And I'm a sober woman today, and I've been sober coming up on, May 3rd of this year. And I'll celebrate 9 years of sobriety. And, a lot of people say God willing. God's always willing. God's always been willing for me to be sober. And as long as I stay willing, as long as I stay open to have this experience and continue to show up and continue to this work, I know in my heart I will celebrate 9 years of continuous sobriety. And that for me is a miracle. Because I couldn't ever envision a life without alcohol. And frankly, I didn't really want to. I didn't want to. Because I didn't know for a really long time, as coming in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, in and out, seeing the steps on the wall, looking for any other solution other than the spiritual one that you guys were offering. I didn't know that alcohol wasn't my problem. I really didn't, and the funny thing is like alcohol kept getting removed from me over and over and over again. And you'll hear that in my story, but the problem is you take alcohol away from me and that's when all my problems show up. And that's when the real problem starts, that sobriety is my problem. And then until I learned to treat that, my sober skin and my spiritual malady, I kept going back to the one thing that was destroying me. And I just couldn't figure out why. And I lived in this place for a really long time until I found out not only what our common problem was, which is our sober skin, what our common solution is, which is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as they're outlined in the big book. And, it's not something I was really willing. I didn't come into Alcoholics Anonymous super willing to do this work. I really had to be beaten down, like completely beaten and broken to be willing to take the direction and take the suggestions and follow in the footsteps of the people who came before me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I really was looking for any other solution other than a spiritual one. You know, the God thing was a difficult thing for me. And that started growing up, as a little girl. I had this feeling of being separate from everything. And, including God, my father, he's a retired Presbyterian minister. And I was brought up in the church. And we would go to church every Sunday in Sunday school. And we were that family that prayed in public. We held hands. And the only thing I ever felt about God was shame and embarrassment. That's it. I said I was embarrassed that I was that family, and I was embarrassed of my parents, and I was embarrassed that we went to church, and I was embarrassed of being a preacher's kid. And I didn't have a feeling of connection with God or any of the people around me. I felt separate, I felt different, and I was afraid all the time. And all I ever wanted in my life was to feel a connection with something or somebody. That's it. That's all I ever wanted. I wanted to feel like I connected with my siblings, and I never did. I wanted to feel like I connected with the kids at school, and I never did. I just didn't feel it. I felt isolated and alone. And when I was 15 years old, I experienced this horrific trauma at the hands of three men. And my parents were called, and my mom showed up at the hospital, and she took one look at me and the broken condition I was in. And her response was less than perfect. It was pretty bad, actually, but it was one of fear and shame and like anger. And how could you let this happen to you? And how could you be so stupid? And so I'm already this young woman who feels uncomfortable in my skin, and I can't connect with anything. And then I experienced this trauma, and I simply don't want to connect with anyone anymore. I'm full of rage. I'm full of hate. I'm full of even more fear than I felt before. And frankly, I don't want to be on this earth anymore. I just want to die. Being in my skin is so painful at this point. It's unbearable. I can't face the world. I can't face the men who did this or going back to school or anything. I don't even want to face my family. I just wanted to disappear. And I will say that before that happened, I'm sure I had a drink here and there. I just don't remember it. It was after that happened that I picked up a drink and I realized the effect that alcohol could produce. That was like a spiritual experience for me, is realizing the effect that alcohol produces, which is that sense of ease and comfort that it talks about that comes at once. That sense of ease and comfort I've been seeking those 15 years that I had been on that planet suffering. And then I experienced this awakening as a result of drinking alcohol, and I felt okay for the first time in my entire life. I felt okay in my skin. I could look you in the eye. I could have fun. I could laugh. I could breathe. I could exist, and I didn't want to kill myself anymore. And that was a miracle. So why wouldn't I want to feel that way all the time, all the time? And any chance I had, I drank. And I early on, I experienced that physical allergy that our book talks about. I wasn't ever the alcoholic who drank just one of anything. In fact, I don't understand it. I don't get it. My father, he enjoys his scotch, his 25-year-old scotch. He swirls it around in his mouth. He likes the taste. He can describe it to you. I will drink Everclear. I'll hold my nose and slam it down because I just want the effect. I don't care what it tastes like. That's all I care about. And one always demands two, demands three, demands four. And that's always the way it's been. But, you know, our literature talks about this alcoholism being a disease of progression. And I know that's the case. I know that's true for me in my experience. You know, that it says that many of us started out as moderate or hard drinkers. You know, and I don't know that I ever was a moderate drinker, but I was a hard drinker for a while. And if a sufficient reason came up for me to stop, I was able to stop for periods of time. But what separates me from the normal drinker is, like, looking back, and I see everything in hindsight. I don't learn anything in the present moment. And that's true today. I still have to learn in hindsight as I screw things up. But so, you know, like when I got pregnant at the age of 19 with my daughter, and you know, for those 9 months or that I was pregnant, I was able to just not drink for 9 months. But what is different, what makes me different from the normal person, like my sisters, for those 9 months, all I could think about is getting this kid out of me, having this baby so I could get to the bar and get loaded again. And come to find out, that's not normal. Like, my sisters enjoyed their pregnancies. Like, they nested and got the nursery ready. And I just was uncomfortable. And as soon as I had my daughter, that's exactly what I did. I went to the bar and I got that sense of ease and comfort that I had been missing. And, you know, I spent many years, like, early, you know, even all the way back then, looking outside of myself to fix what was wrong inside of me, because I didn't know I had an internal condition that needed to be fixed from the inside out. I had no idea. I suffer from these delusions that something, the solution to my problem is outside of me, that if I just find the right husband, the right job, if I have the right dollar amount in my bank account, you know, if I have enough babies, I'll be okay in here. I'll be just like everybody else. So I, you know, I get married and divorced at a young age, you know, and, you know, I convince myself that I'm this great mother, you know, just simply because I'm present physically with my child, and I'm a single mom for 3 years. You know, but I'm delusional and I'm crazy, and I'm driving around with my daughter intoxicated, and I'm putting her in harm's way. And I, you know, I sought many ways to treat my alcoholism, and my life was pretty unmanageable very early on. Like, I always was able to keep the image off. Like, I always had a roof over my head, but the roof was always changing. And I always had a job, but that was always changing. I couldn't hold a job. There was nothing. I had no longevity of anything in my life. And when my daughter was 3 years old, my finances became so unmanageable. And I basically went back to my ex-husband to extort more money. And he'd had enough and cut me off and took primary physical custody of our child. And I'm going to tell you, like, I love this child more than I can put into words. And, but when he took custody, I did everything externally that you would expect a mother to do. I kicked and I screamed. I think I even tried to run him over in the parking lot of the courthouse, made a scene. She's my daughter. How dare you? How dare you? I gave birth to her. But if I were to tell you the truth, which I wasn't capable of doing at that time in my life, I would have told you that I was relieved, because I didn't want to be a mother. I didn't want to be responsible for another person. I didn't want to be responsible for a three-year-old. I wanted to drink. I wanted to party. And, you know, back then, drinking was fun. I hadn't crossed that invisible line where it became, like Bill Wilson talks about, you know, that necessity. It was enjoyable at that time, you know, where it ceases to be a luxury and becomes a necessity. It may have been a necessity, but I didn't know it at the time. And I was still experiencing a lot of joy and that fun and that, you know. And without my daughter in my life, I'm able to, you know, do what I want to do. And, like, alcohol really starts to slowly become my master, although I don't realize it at the time, that it's dictating every move in my life. Like, I moved to Manhattan because the restaurant and bars are open until 5 a.m. I work in the restaurant and bar industry, and because no one cares if I come to work loaded. You know, every relationship I ever had was centered around alcohol and other substances. And if you didn't drink the way I drank, or provide me with the means and money I need to drink, and if you dared to call me out on my drinking and tell me I need to slow down, moderate, or do any of those things, or maybe get help, I just moved on to the next one. And there was always a next one, because I always have a plan B. God forbid I spend 30 seconds alone in my skin. It's not happening. It's not happening. You know, and by the time I'm 27, I meet the love of my life in a bar. Our lives locked across a crowded room, and we went home together that night. 2 weeks later, we signed a lease. And a month after that, or a month or two after that, he pulls out a 2-carat diamond ring. And, you know, I really felt in that moment that I had arrived, like this was my life, like I was going to be okay, like somebody loves me enough, values me enough to put this huge, expensive piece of jewelry on me, and I'm going to be just like everybody else. This relationship, this marriage is going to fix me, although he doesn't know one true fact about me. Not a single one, not even what I do for a living. And we live under the same roof. I lied about everything, stuff I didn't need to lie about. Like why would I need to, tell him I'm an executive assistant when I'm a receptionist? My ego is so big and I don't even realize that. It's just ridiculous. I can't just be me. I can't just tell the truth because you might hate me. You might reject me. And so I'm loaded all the time and I marry this guy on the beach and 6 months later, and I haven't stopped drinking the entire time. And 6 months after that, when I got pregnant with our child, I was still drinking every day. And at this point I couldn't stop and I didn't want to because my disease had really begun to progress at this point. And this is when things started to really get dark in my story. I had some complications with this pregnancy and I went to the hospital and they gave me the wrong medication. And it ended the pregnancy in a very ugly way. I had to have surgery and the hospital owned their mistake. They admitted they made a mistake. And I remember coming home from the hospital and sitting in our living room when my husband is just pacing back and forth and he's yelling and he's saying how many people he's going to sue. And he's so upset. And I'm terrified. I'm just terrified. I'm terrified he's going to leave. I'm terrified I'm going to lose this life that I've constructed for myself, that I believe is keeping me together. And all I can think in my terror is how I'm going to fix this. What am I going to do? I know this man wants a family and I know he wants a child. So how can I fix this? And the only thing my absolutely insane brain could come up with is I'll get pregnant again. And I did. 5 weeks after this horrific miscarriage, I'm pregnant again. And I didn't want this child. I didn't want to be pregnant. And frankly, I didn't want to live anymore. And I couldn't breathe a sober breath. I didn't want to stop. Not for a baby, not for anybody at this point. I just couldn't. And I didn't want to. And it was so full of fear and shame. Like what kind of woman does this to her child? What kind of woman, doesn't want her baby? Like what's wrong with me? And I can't tell people that because what will you think of me? And, but what happens is, during this pregnancy, like I start to get exposed for who I truly am. Like my husband starts to see the truth of who we really married. And, ended up in the psych ward twice during this pregnancy. And as a direct result of everything I did, my son was born. He was born 3 months premature and he was 2 pounds. And the first time I ever laid eyes on him, he was in an incubator in a NICU covered in tubes, not breathing on his own. It's the first time I saw my son. And I will tell you that when I looked at my son, like in that moment, I loved him as much as I was capable of loving any human being at that point in my life. But what came with that love is this overwhelming shame and guilt because I knew I put him there. I knew he couldn't breathe because of me. I knew he couldn't be held by anybody because of me. I knew I did that. And all I wanted was for that voice in my head that told me that I should just kill myself, that this life would be better off without me, that my children would be better off without me. I wanted it to shut up. And I knew the one thing that would stop that. Alcohol, more and more alcohol. But here's the problem. As my disease progresses, I need more and I need more. And it's not producing that same effect. I'm not getting the relief. And the relief I'm getting is for shorter periods of time. And it's coming with more and more internal and external consequences. And I'm starting to suffer. And my little boy stayed in the hospital for 5 weeks because of what I did. And I will tell you what it says in the big book that, many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them even though we wanted to. That is 100% accurate because I so badly wanted to be a good mother. I wanted to be a good wife. I wanted to be a good sister and daughter. I wanted to be these things and I just didn't have the power to do that. The type of mother that I am, that I was the mother who nodded out and dropped her child on the floor. I left my son in a hot car and covered his face, covered him up with a blanket on a hot day to go get a drink. And I didn't want to, bring in one of the worst neighborhoods in Philadelphia. And I was the kind of mother that when my son was 8 months old, I got arrested with him in the car and my husband had to come pick him up from the police station. And I remember getting bailed out the next day. And I remember coming home and my husband is in our living room and he has everything packed. And he has all my son's things packed and all his things packed and he's leaving me. And what do? I try to pull out every manipulative tactic I can think of. Please don't leave. You said in sickness and in health, we're married. You can't do this. I'm sick. All of these things, just begging and pleading. And And then finally that man looked at me and he said, you know, I'll stay with you and we can fix this marriage, but we're moving in with my parents today and you have to go to treatment and you have to get sober. And I looked at that man and I looked at my son, knowing full well that he was going to get up and walk out of that room and he was going to take my child with him. And I said, no. I said, no. Because here's the thing. The need for alcohol was more important in that moment than my child. And I didn't know for many years until I sat down with a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous after years and years of beating myself up and killing myself at the idea that I chose alcohol over my husband, over my son, that for reasons yet obscure, when she opened up that book and read to me what it said, and there is a solution that for reasons yet obscure, most alcoholics have lost the power of choice when it comes to a drink. And I have a mind that will tell me things like, you know what, you'll fix this tomorrow. You'll get them back tomorrow. Worry about that tomorrow. But in this moment, you need alcohol. That's what my brain tells me, that somehow, some way, I'll be able to work this out later. And it wasn't until that woman explained to me the power of alcohol that I had lost any power of choice at this point, and that I was beyond human aid, and I didn't know it. I had no idea. I really believed, after I spent the next, you know, 15 or so years, 10 years, I guess, trying to be my own power and choose not to drink, but not being able to. I didn't know. I just didn't know. And then he left, and you know, I'm too cowardly to kill myself, but I will, you know, I was devastated in that empty apartment with no husband, no children, my first husband seeing what a disaster I've become, and I just want to die, but I'm too much of a coward. And so I just lie in bed and I stop eating, and alcohol becomes my only, you know, the only thing I'm putting in my body for 2 straight months. And at the end of this run, my mom has a gut feeling that something's wrong with her child. And this woman who I've demonized and tortured most of her life and blamed for everything that's ever happened to me gets in her car and drives 2 hours and shows up at my doorstep to find me 75 pounds, burning up with a fever of 106, riddled all over my body with infection, and takes me to the hospital where she's told I'm going to die and that there's no way I can survive this heart infection, these blood infections, and this all this stuff that's happened to my body. And this woman who's told, like both of my parents are told, like, you have to say goodbye to her. It's time, you know, bring your family. Is doing nothing but standing at my bedside, trying to be helpful. She's a nurse, trying to make sure I'm comfortable, make sure I have the right medications. And what am I doing? I'm screaming at her, I'm cursing at her. How fucking dare you? How could you do this to me? Why didn't you just let me die? Why didn't you, you know, because I don't care about anybody else. I don't care about anybody else's pain. I care about my own pain and I want it to end. I never cared about my mother having to bury a child. I never cared about my children losing their mom. I never cared about anybody but myself. It was always about me. And I didn't know what I was really suffering from, was selfishness and self-centeredness. And that was killing me. That was killing me, literally, you know, and I would keep going like this for several more years. You know, it's funny how Bill talks about it in his story. I absolutely love it. And here's the thing. If you're hearing my story tonight, none of your external consequences match mine. That's fine. None of the stuff that happened to me, not the 11 felonies, not the loss of both my children, not the loss of custody of both my children, not the loss of both my marriages, you know, not ending up homeless, bouncing from place to place. None of that stuff is what makes me an alcoholic. And all of our external consequences are going to look the same. I mean, you're going to look different. What I suffer from is alcoholism, meaning like when I pick up, when I start, I can't stop. And when I'm stopped, I'm guaranteed to pick up again. I've lost that power of choice. And that I have this spiritual sickness, this malady, this selfishness and self-centeredness that runs me. And I don't feel comfortable in my sober skin. And that I use alcohol to fix that. And the interesting thing about external consequences, it doesn't matter how bad they get. Bill Wilson talks about it again in his story, saying, you know, how the mind and body are marvelous mechanism. How he endured this torture for years and was able to keep going. That's my story. All these horrible things are happening outside of me. I end up in and out of detoxes, in and out of treatment facilities, in and out of jail cells. And over again, I get separated from alcohol. Every single time, the external consequences are piling up. They're getting worse and worse and worse. And I still keep going. And here's the crazy thing. I keep getting separated from alcohol. You know, law enforcement does a beautiful job of separating me from alcohol. It's very effective. You know, when I'm in jail, I'm as sober as I'm ever going to be. When I'm in treatment, I'm as sober as I'm ever going to be. But instead, I'm in treatment, I just grab a boyfriend and I roll. Or if I'm in jail, I just, you know, go to church and I pretend to believe in a power that I don't believe in. Or I read incessantly and I make a bunch of promises to people that I probably know I'm never going to keep. you know, and somewhere inside of me, I think like, hey, this time I'm going to get out and I'm going to get my kids and I'm going to do all these great things. But every time they let me out, every time they open the doors of whatever facility I'm in, I drink again. And I have no idea why. It doesn't matter if it's been 11 months, 9 months, 6 months, a year and a half. It doesn't matter. I drink. And I don't know why. I don't know why. And, you know, I didn't end up in Alcoholics Anonymous in the rooms until, you know, I knew of its existence, but I didn't really end up in the rooms until my son was 6 years old, being raised by another woman, because I was that tornado this book talks about, in and out of everybody's lives, in and out of my kids' lives, like showing up every 30, 60, 90 days, you know, here's mommy again, throw me a party. You know, I hated this woman who was raising my son, and she was doing everything I was incapable of doing. I just hated her for it. I was convinced she stole my child from me. That's how delusional I am. As if this woman wanted to be the one getting up in the middle of the night when he's sick, or, you know, taking him to school in the morning, or buying him his school clothes. Like, she did all that and I couldn't. And, anyway, I end up in the rooms of AA, not because I'm attracted to what's going on in AA. I mean, in fact, I came in and I immediately disqualified myself. I don't really belong here, but whatever. I got paroled here. I was in a halfway house, and a requirement for being in the halfway house is I had to go to 5 meetings a week and get a paper signed. So of course I found the most convenient location. It was an AA clubhouse down the street where you could smoke indoors, because I smoked at the time, and a lot of cute boys went there. And that was it. That was my home group. That's all I need. Cute boys, cigarettes, and you know, and that's what I did. I used AA as a dating service for a while, and I dressed up the outside. You know, I got a job at a diner, and you know, I shoved all the cash I made from flirting with a bunch of, you know, dirty old men at the diner, and shoved, you know, put it in my drawer because I didn't want to pay anybody back, or put it in the bank because I knew I owed too many people. And you know, I got stuff back, like I always do. And I saw those steps on the wall, and I did. I'll do that one and that one, but, you know, and I didn't know what any of it meant. I would raise my hand and I would tell you about my day, and I would flirt and I would leave. That's it. And, you know, after about 90 days of being in that halfway house, I had saved up enough money for an apartment, and I thought it was good. I don't need these meetings anymore. I don't need this support system anymore. I don't need to do anything. And I've even got my kids back in my life. Well, sort of. I have supervised visitation, so I think I'm fine. And, a month into living in that apartment, I was at my daughter's lacrosse game, and my six-year-old little boy looked at me and he says, you know, you're not my real mom. Kim's my real mom because she takes care of me every day, and you just gave birth to me. And it felt like somebody stabbed me in the chest. Like, I couldn't breathe. The pain was so great. Like, I couldn't breathe. And I think deep down, I knew it was true. I think that's why it hurt so bad. I knew it was true. I had never been a real mom to this boy. And all I wanted was that pain to go away. And I had no other solution in my life other than a chemical one. So, and I knew immediately what would make that pain go away, what would make it all right. And that was alcohol. And needless to say, like, that night I was found overdosed on the floor of my apartment by my landlord. And what started then is what our big book talks about, the phenomenon of craving. I drink one, and a year and a half later, I can't stop. Can't stop. And it doesn't matter that there are warrants out for my arrest. It doesn't matter that there are eviction notices on my door. It doesn't matter that a couple days prior, and let me know if this sounds familiar, if any of you ever read the doctor's opinion, but a couple days prior, I had a court date set to go favorably to me, an important meeting set to go favorably to me when it came to getting custody of my son or even retaining any type of visitation. But I pick up one, and that important date was not met. Because alcohol became paramount to everything. It's the most important thing in my life. I couldn't even show up to retain any kind of visitation or custody of my child. That's how powerful alcohol is. And, you know, I couldn't stop for a year and a half until I was physically separated by law enforcement yet again, sent away to a jail cell yet again, and repeated the same cycle. Got out after over a year. Went to a recovery house, went to meetings only because I was required to. Met another solution who was living at another recovery house, who was an aspiring rap artist. And we rented a room together 2 weeks later. And that was the last, that was the beginning of the end. That was my last run. It was the shortest, most painful thing that I had ever experienced in my life. And, you know, and this run was different because all my other runs I had nothing left, like nothing, like homeless, maybe a bag of clothes, and I was couch hopping, right? But this one was different. I had a roof over my head. I had a car. I had money in my pocket, and I wanted to die. And here's what happened. you know, I love the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous so much. And I didn't for a really long time. I was one of those people who even this time around in sobriety, I would hear it was a tradition meeting and immediately check out. But I started to really fall in love with the traditions. And one of my favorite traditions is the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop. But what I love even more than that tradition is that none of you ever judged whether I even had that desire or not. Because I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for years. Without a desire to stop. My only desire was that the consequences would stop. That's it. I wanted to stop losing my kids. I wanted to stop losing jobs. I wanted people to stop believing me, but I didn't want to be sober. I didn't want to stop drinking. But that night, May 2nd, 2012, 4:30 in the morning, and I am on the highway driving to one of the worst neighborhoods in Philadelphia for a drink. And for the first time in my entire life, I have the most overwhelming and overpowering desire to turn my car around and go home. And I physically can't do it. I physically can't do it. That's all I wanted to do was stop. And I couldn't. And that's when I knew. That was it. That was like my first step experience. Because I'd never wanted to stop. I was drinking against my will. And what did I do in that moment? I screamed out to a power that my whole life I had used as, you know, as this maybe... like Santa Claus, like, oh, okay, God, like I'll go to you in a clutch. And when you don't give me what I want, like a lenient parole officer or, you know, a release date, I'll turn my back on you immediately. But I screamed out to this power that I didn't know whether, if I even believed in. And this was my prayer. And I'm sorry if this offends anyone, but my prayer was, dear God, please fucking kill me or stop me, screaming it over and over and over again, because I couldn't do it anymore. That jumping off point, I can't live another second like this. I don't know how I'm going to live sober, and I don't know how I'm going to live continuing to drink. I can't do either one anymore. I couldn't face it. 12 hours later, I had handcuffs on me. I don't know how God shows up in your life, but he has no problem showing up in the form of law enforcement for me. It's very effective, like I said. And what happened is, of course, like I have this amazing, beautiful moment of brokenness. And I felt that power in that moment, like that, you know, but of course, like the ego is insidious. And, you know, within a few hours of realizing the consequences that I was facing, you know, I immediately start running on fear and ego. And I try to call everyone I can think of, like, how am I going to get myself out of this jam? And one by one, everybody hangs up on me. And thank God, every human power I had in my life just said no. I had nothing but to rely on God. And I'm thinking, because my ideas are so, you know, right all the time, is that, oh, well, at this point, I have 11 felonies, and I got locked up on, like, I don't know what state you guys are in even, but, you know, we have a summary retail theft, which is like a ticket. So I'm thinking, oh, well, this won't be a big deal. Like, maybe I'll get a little stint in county and dry out and go on with my life, and everything will be okay. Well, that's not what happened. Apparently, my parole officer was not okay with me having 11 felonies and continuing to commit crimes. So I stood in front of a judge who sentenced me to 1 to 3 years to the state correctional facility. And I went to state prison. And for 18 months, you know, again, in hindsight, I was able to see the empirical evidence that what I suffer from does not come in a bottle. It's how if I look at how I behave for those 18 months, just separated from alcohol with no solution in my life, not a chemical one or a spiritual one, I can see what it is that I suffer from. I was an absolute monster. You know, I'm calling home on my parents' dime. The money they put on my phone account, I'm telling them what they need to do for me. Or I'm writing a long apology letters home about how sorry I am, but maybe if you were better parents or siblings, I wouldn't be here. P.S. I need money, send commissary. And like, I think this is okay because it's always about me. And after 18 months, I get out. And I still have ideas, the insanity. I'm getting out of state parole. I am going to a recovery house with a 350-pound state parole officer who's terrifying. I have a 7 p.m. curfew. I don't have a penny in my pocket, and I'm wearing my niece's hand-me-down clothes, and no one's talking to me. And I still think I know how to run my life. And so I get out, and within a couple days of me being home, every idea that I had, like all these brilliant ideas of like reconnecting with the rap star ex-boyfriend who got shot a couple times while I was in jail and moving into a couple's recovery house. Like this is how my brain works. Like, but all those ideas were smashed within a couple of days, and I was left with me, just me in my sober skin and nothing else except God. And I was in so much pain I cried out again, and because I couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. Like, I'm in the fetal position, 18 months, completely dry, nothing in my system, and I want to die all over again, and I can't figure out why. Why am I sober, and it feels this bad? Why? Why? And who do I cry out to because no one else is around me? God, what do I do now? God, help me. And God shows me what to do, and I walk up the steps of the Greater Northeast Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the meeting where I got sober, the place that saved my life. And I saw God for the first time in the eyes of a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd been in church my whole life, and I never experienced anything like this, ever. And it was different in this way, that I had seen happy, joyous, and free members of AA for years, but I didn't believe them because I didn't know them. I thought they were liars. You didn't drink like me. You didn't know your story. Like, you didn't have as bad as me or whatever. But what I saw this time, what God did for me, was that he put people in front of me who I drank with, who I knew were just as hopeless as me. People who were living on the streets of Philadelphia at one point who couldn't get a second sober. And these people were lit up. They were walking around talking about God, talking about the 12 steps, shining from the inside out. And I knew they didn't do that. They didn't do that. Something bigger was at work here. And I started to go through my steps. I became willing, as only the dying can be. Like, I was like, please show me what to do. I don't care. I didn't understand any of it. In fact, I remember, you know, kneeling on the floor, saying this third step prayer, and immediate flashbacks to my childhood, that kneeling, you know, in front of other women, holding hands with this girl, praying in front of people, shame, right? Saying these words, we have girls behind us saying, who took my cigarettes? I'm like, I don't know what God has to do with any of this, but whatever. I'll do whatever you tell me to do. And that woman did exactly what she was supposed to do, because I got up and she slid that piece of paper in front of me and told me to start writing, because it says it right there. The answer is right there in our book. I didn't know what decision I was making. I read that stuff on the wall for years and I'm like, okay, I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the power of God as I understood God. No idea how I would ever conceive of turning my life over to a power I'm not even sure I believe in, right? It's simple. This decision, although it's a vital and crucial step, could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of what was blocking. Made a decision to go through the rest of the steps, to write that inventory, to tell the truth, to take action, something I had never done. I'd made the resolutions, never a decision. And that's it. I started writing. And of course, I write, I don't know, 27 pages and nine, you know, this is all resentments because it's not me. It's you. It's everybody else. And I have this story I come in AA with and I want to tell everybody about it. She's like, she tricked me. You know, in fact, she told me, just write these first two columns. I'll go over the other two columns with you. And it's like, she didn't want to spoil the surprise for me until we sat down for like 5 hours while she explained to me every single like decision based on self and fear that I had made that had placed me in a position to be hurt, right? Ooh. And what happens in this fifth step? Listen, I'm not going to tell you I walked out of there floating on air. That happened after the fifth step I did most recently this year. I just finished that a few months ago. But my initial fifth step, I'm telling you, I did not feel good because I saw the truth for the first time. Like, I had this massive shift in perception during this fifth step. And that was the miracle of it. Like, take my mother, for instance. That woman had a page to herself. She had a page to herself. You know, what she did to me when I was 15 years old. I held on to that more than what those men had done to me. How dare she? But what I realized, as I have this conversation with this woman, this amazing woman who saved my life. As we worked our way down these columns to that fourth column, and not only how horribly I had treated my mother, how selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and all of these things I had been towards my mother, but that I had taken this one thing that my mother did when I was 15 years old, and I allowed it to blind me to every beautiful thing my mother ever did for me my whole life. Every time she showed up in treatment centers and detoxes with fresh clothes, every time she put money on my account so I could call people, every time she invited me to family dinners where nobody wanted me, my mother loved me unconditionally. That's it. That's the truth. And I can't see that. My resentment blinds me to you. It blinds me to the truth. And I started to get that out of the way. And I could see that. And I didn't like who I saw anymore. And I wanted to change that. I'm grateful that I had the experience of being so uncomfortable after that inventory. I saw who I didn't want to be anymore. And I was willing to have God remove all of these things, all these defects of character. fast forward 8 years, like I'm going to pick and choose what I want to hold on to. There's nothing like that gift of desperation, that brokenness that'll lead me back to my knees and back to begging God, like remove all of this. And, you know, it's almost like that's been like the pattern of my sobriety is like, you know, I would love to say that after that moment, having that wonderful experience, getting on my knees and saying that 7-step prayer, that like I started to like just grow on this upward trajectory to try to be in the likeness of my creator. It's just not it. I screw up constantly. But what I'm grateful for is that when the pain gets great enough, I'm back on my knees. And because this has become my default mode, the work that we do here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And for that, I'm grateful. And it's amazing. Like, listen, I saw God in you guys in my second step, but I felt God within me in my ninth step. You know, that fundamental idea of God that is deep down within all of us, I felt God for the first time. You know, when I sat in front of the people that I had harmed the most in this world, and I didn't say I was sorry, I said I was wrong. And I gave them an opportunity to tell me how I had hurt them. And I asked them how I could make it right. And not only that, I followed that up with direct action, because I can make any declaration and I can say I'm wrong. But if I don't take the action to clean it up, I've done nothing, And I love our ninth step promises. You know, every meeting I go to, you know, I hear them read all the time, and everybody in the meeting is, you know, every time we get to that point, are these extravagant promises? Everyone says, we think not. We think not. Well, for me, they're the most extravagant promises anybody had ever put in front of me in my entire life. For me, these are extravagant promises. I never knew a life without fear. I never knew this new freedom and a new happiness. Like you were, I would hear these things and I would feel like there's no way that I could experience that. There's no way. But once I started making these amends, like I was sleeping through the night, I was looking people in the eye, I wasn't afraid anymore. I was connecting with people. That connection that I had been missing since a little girl was there. It was there. I felt things like empathy and love for other people for the first time in my entire life. And thank God I needed to do that work, you know, and continue that in 10 and 11 and to carry that message in 12. And when I sat down with another woman in Alcoholics Anonymous and I opened that book and I got to see her life be transformed, her family be restored, her relationships be restored. I saw the power of God through all of this. It was like everything came full circle. Everything came full circle. And I just knew what God, you know, I experienced God. The God that I had been missing in church my whole life, I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. I found here. And every time I get to experience this God on a daily basis, provided I get out of my own way. But that's also not my story. And like in the years that I've been sober, you know, I've really messed a lot of things up and, you know, I make a lot of mistakes. But I get to learn through this process. And I've been able to learn is that despite all, you know, we do get these amazing promises. We get the promises in the ninth step. We get the promises in the 10th step. But I found out over the years what the real purpose of these steps are, specifically 9, but all of the steps, is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people around us. What does that look like in my life? How am I of maximum service to God and the people around me? That would, you know, that look like when it looks like being a mother to my daughter. And you know, my daughter didn't want to hear amends. She didn't want to hear a word I had to say. She said no. She just wanted me to show up and take action. And you guys taught me how to be a mom. I didn't know how to be a mom. But you guys taught me how to show up and just love her exactly how she is, not try to fix her, not try to change her, not try to make her something she's not. And, you know, I had made an amends to my sister, Amy, my oldest sister, early on. And I'm beyond grateful for this. I'm so grateful I got to have this experience. My sister was really sick. And we had a really difficult relationship growing up. We couldn't get along. You know, we fought more than anybody else in the family. And when I went to go make this amends, you know, it's exactly what the book talks about. Sometimes feuds of longstanding just fall away. And that's immediately when I started talking, my sister started owning her wrongs that she had done to me. And what came out of this conversation was the most beautiful friendship I had ever had with my sister or any of my siblings up until that point. you know, because my sister at that time, she was severely anorexic. And she was living in this place of shame and fear that I had lived most of my life. And there wasn't a person in the world she felt comfortable talking to about this. Not my parents, not her children, not her husband, nobody. And she felt completely alone. But because of the amends process and because of the 12 steps and because of my story, my pain, my experience, my sister was able to talk to me and feel less alone. And for a year and a half, I had the most beautiful friendship I had ever imagined with my sister until my mom called me a few years ago, 5:30 in the morning, and told me that my sister was dead. And those promises tell me, like, we will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. And I intuitively knew this had nothing to do with me, that I needed to show up and help my parents bury their firstborn child, that I needed to show up and help her children bury their mother. And God gave me this absolutely beautiful gift. And in the moment, it doesn't feel like a gift because I'm waking up crying and I'm going to bed crying, you know, because I lost a person I don't know my life without. And, but God put me in a position to be standing next to my mother in the exact moment she saw her daughter in the casket for the first time, and to be able to comfort my mother and be there for her and make it about her. And that's not of my doing. That is not of my power, because on my power, I'm in the bathroom getting loaded. I'm in a jail. I'm in a rehab, and I'm anywhere but in that moment. What I'm learning about spirituality the longer I stay sober is that it has nothing to do with like a yoga class or, you know, a 2-hour long meditation and a retreat. And by the way, I've embraced all of these things in my life through my 11th step. I seek God in all these other ways in my life, and I love them, and I'm not bashing them in any way. But how I connect with God and how I truly end up feeling God is through walking through pain. Listen, none of us are going to avoid pain. It's not happening. It's part of, no human is going to avoid pain. It's part of the life experience. We are all going to experience loss, death, betrayal. You know, I've had 2 long-term relationships in the time that I've been sober. I stayed too long in both. One couldn't stay sober. The other couldn't stay away from other women. And what I've learned about going through these painful experiences is that I experience God through pain. And spirituality comes with being in more pain than I could possibly imagine. Like, I remember being at my sister's funeral and never feeling more in the moment than I had ever felt in my entire life. Present there and experiencing the most agonizing thing I've ever experienced in my entire life, but knowing in my heart that somehow everything was going to be okay. That for me is God. That's what God is for me. And you know, and all these mistakes I've made, like staying in these messy relationships and how I get away from the work that we do in the body, you know, of these steps. You know, I get really good at 2-stepping. I'll tell you that much. I'll run around the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, admit I'm powerless, and go help people. And I'll forget that I can't transmit something I haven't got. Because when I live in these sick relationships or grab onto something that's a human power and try to use it to, you know, bring joy in my life, and or I stay too long, or I try to play God in a situation, become agnostic when it comes to something I just want to have in my life, I get sick all over again. And I stop being honest, and I stop practicing the 11 steps that come prior to 12. And what I've learned for me is that, yes, while nothing will so much ensure immunity from a next drink, which is absolutely true, it's been my experience. I intensive work with other alcoholics. Like, I, through these terrible situations that I've been in, the one thing that never changed in my life was that I was always in the middle, in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous and actively sponsoring women. But here's the difference. When I'm sponsoring women on Sarah's juices, it's like, oh, her again? Oh my God. Like, I don't know if I can listen to this. And I'm just the annoyance, and it feels like I have to. What happens is when I go back to the work and I tell the truth and I stop telling you that bullshit lie, that thing that I tell you, the biggest lie I ever told in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, is that I'm fine. When I stop telling you that and I start getting down to where I'm afraid, where I'm resentful, where I'm dishonest, and I continue to look and be mindful and watchful of these things and bring God into them and continue to do that inventory, and I keep my side of the street clean through current amends, current 10-step amends, those newcomers become the bright spot of my life, just like the book talks about. When they call, I experience joy. When they have things to tell me, I feel their pain when their heart is breaking. That empathy comes back, that love comes back. And it's not something I have to do, it's something I get to do. And that's how I can gauge well, Sarah, you might want to go back and do some more work because this is becoming one of those things you have to do again. And I'm grateful because I'm surrounded by people who love me enough to tell me the truth and get me back into the work. And I'm also grateful that for some reason that God's grace is just, no matter how much pain I've been in, you know, I've always been driven back into doing more work. Just like I said, just finished going through my steps again. And that was a very uncomfortable experience because the last thing I want to do at 8 years sober is admit I know absolutely nothing. I know nothing. And I want to continue to know nothing. The last thing I want to do is go back to my old home group and make an amends to everybody there because my ego got in the way. The last thing I want to do is go make an amends to a woman who was the other woman in my relationship for 2 years who knew about me and I didn't know about her. And the last thing I want to do is go back to her and make an amends because of my reaction when I found out. But I did, and I walked away from that freer than I can even put into words. There's something that comes with humility that I can't even describe, but I have to be willing to go there. I have to be willing to go there. And that, you know, I know it kind of sounds like that my life just sounds like nothing but pain and tragedy for the last year. That isn't true. My life today is absolutely joyful. I'm not talking about just happiness. Anything can make me happy. Like a pair of new shoes will make me happy, but I'm talking about joy, something experienced in my spirit. Like that feeling you get when you hear a song that you love or when you hug someone dearly, like that's joy. You know, I as a result of the, you know, being an AA and taking these 12 steps, like, listen, I become employable. Like, here's a funny thing. I am an 11-time felon. 4 of them are first degree. And I work in a corporate law firm with $1 million clients. You can't tell me there's no God. I'm sorry. I was sworn in as a notary public for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania in the same courthouse where I was sentenced to state prison. Like, that's, and you know, that stuff is like stuff I can't even, there's no explanation other than a power greater than myself at work there. There's just nothing. There's nothing else to explain that. You know, I live in a house that I love with my best friend and 6 cats. I have a brand new car and a great credit score because guess what? I paid the money back. Like, it's called a financial amends, you know, the thing I avoided doing my whole life. I opened bills today and they're paid early. You know, but all that stuff could be gone tomorrow. Like, listen, we all suffered. Everybody, a lot of people suffered during this pandemic. You know, life is uncertain. We don't know. We don't know about that stuff. But what I do know is that every time like my external has been shaken, I have an inner peace within me that I never had before in my entire life. I know that today I play the role God assigns, and those roles are amazing because I get to be a daughter today. I get to be a mother today. I get to be a sister today. I get to be an employee today. I get to be a friend today. I get to be a sponsor today. I get to do these things. That's unbelievable. I'm a trusted member of society in my community and within my family. And that is a miracle. What's a miracle today is that my mom calls me up to ask me how to help my brother who still suffers from this disease. That's a miracle. That my family asks me my opinion on anything is a miracle to me. And I'm going to end with this. I have a son I haven't seen in 14 years. You know, that when he was 6 years old, that was one of the last times I saw him. And when I started going through my steps, when I first started going through my steps, I reached out to make an amends to, you know, to his father and to, you know, his mother and to him through letters. And they did not respond. And I followed up on multiple different occasions and they haven't responded. And that's their right. And a few years ago, I guess it was interesting. It was Easter weekend 4 years ago. I was really jammed up about this. And I'm so grateful that I was taught early on that AA doesn't tell us to go to, you know, 20 different people and get 20 different opinions and take whichever one suits us best, like that it's a God-reliant program, that we have amazing people to help, you know, direct us and maybe see insights that we can't see from within or get some objectivity. But what it tells us, you know, what the big book tells us to do is to, like, when we're indecisive about something, to ask God for an intuitive thought or decision, to relax or take it easy, to give it over to God. And I didn't know anything of this. That's like the opposite of who I am. I don't like to relax. I'm a stress box. Like, I want to just, like, I think if I stress more about a situation, it'll make it happen. So a few years ago, like, I'm jammed up and, And I don't know what to do. And I have well-meaning people in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous saying, hey, get a lawyer. You never officially lost rights, you know, make it happen. Go see your boy. And instead of running with that, I just went to God and said, God, show me what to do. Please. I miss my son. I don't know what he looks like. Just show me. I haven't seen him in 10 years. Please show me what to do. And I kept asking, and it was Good Friday 4 years ago. And I typed my son's name into Instagram, and a girlfriend who made a joke Instagram account. So I saw his face for the first time in a decade, and he's beautiful and he's happy and he's loved. And I felt this sense of peace come into my heart that the restoration of this relationship is going to happen on God's time, and it's not going to be on mine. And it may never look the way I want it to look. Listen, I send a card on the same date every month with some cash in it, no name, nothing. That's all I can do. And I will do that till the day that I die, if that's all I ever get. And if the restoration of this relationship looks like my boy helping other boys who've lost their mom, that's what it looks like. It doesn't have to fit my mold. That's the miracle of it. Because, and here's the other miracle, is that for my whole life, my sobriety was contingent on an external solution, external condition. Like, I can't get and stay sober if this relationship ends. I can't get and stay sober if somebody I love dies. I can't get and stay sober if I don't get my kids back. Here's what it says in the big book, though. And here's what my experience says. Let no alcoholic say they cannot fully recover unless they have their entire family back. It isn't true. I have fully recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body, and I don't have my son back, and I may never have my son back. I have a life of beauty and purpose and joy today. And that's a direct result of doing this work. And it's available to anyone, provided they do the work. Anyway, I am so grateful to all of you for having me here tonight. Thank you.
Sarah, that was amazing. Thank you so much. I'm going to allow people to unmute and thank Sarah.
God bless you, Sarah.
Thank you, Sarah.
So thank you,
Sarah. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Sarah. That was awesome.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sarah.
Thank you, Sarah.
Sarah, thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you, right. Sarah.
I'm going to take the meeting back. Oh, I need to recover from that. Let's give Sarah a break. And I'll take a deep breath here. That was amazing. So the seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. So I'm also going to remind you that we're looking for your questions at the user questions. Please send those. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. Are there any announcements tonight for the good of AA? Feel free to unmute. All right, hearing none. Well, I got to put in a plug in for Simple Actions. Our regular home group meets on Monday night, so tomorrow night we'll be doing step 12, but a week from tomorrow night, we're having our supper and a speaker without the supper. But we've got Jack D from Baltimore, Maryland, is going to come tell his story. That's a week from tomorrow night at the regular Simple Actions home group meeting. Speaking of a home group, Simple Actions is one. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available here after we close the meeting. Please stick around You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. Or if you're shy, feel free to send an email to info@simpleactions.net. All right. So let's see how we're doing on questions. I'm not used to running the meeting from a laptop. Let's see, let me get the right page. You guys are so kind, bear with me here. Oh, Sarah, you cracked me wide open. My heart, my heart, my broken open heart. What was different, if anything? It sounded like you came out of doing 18 months and walked up the stairs of an AA meeting. Were you different? Was the AA meeting different? What, if anything, helped you make the turn in that moment?
Yeah, I really believe the AA meeting had been the same. For a long time, I thought people weren't talking about a solution. And what happened, I believe, is that I got stripped of everything outside of myself that I had always relied on. And it was almost like God knew that if a boyfriend had come in the picture, if some job had come in the picture, like I basically had to be stripped of anything that I'd been relying on, any external thing that I had normally relied on. I had none of it. I didn't even have an Obama phone at the time. Like, I had nothing. And I'm truly grateful for that. And I'm grateful the fact, like, something about being in agonizing pain. And this is true today as well. Like, I can run around on fear and ego, even in sobriety, for significant periods of time and get really uncomfortable internally. But when the pain internally gets great enough, something happens and my eyes and my ears start to open up and I start like hearing things differently. And, you know, I knew, you know, that these 12 steps existed. I just didn't know they were in the book. And it was, I had no idea they were in the book, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, I never understood that. I didn't know. And as soon as I saw, like, I was broken, and then I saw these people, I was like, well, what did you do? And that was it. Like, I became willing. And I think it was always me. Like, I think AA has been pretty, like, listen, you're always going to hear little different messages. And, you know, you're going to hear the, hey, just don't drink and make a meeting. And listen, if I don't want to get sober, that's the guy I'm going to gravitate to. But when I want a solution and when I want to stop suffering in my sober skin, I'm going to gravitate to the man or woman who's talking about this, like this work that we do, these 12 steps, like the action that we take. And that's what happened.
How did you meet your first sponsor? Did she pick you up, or did you approach her or him, or how'd that go?
She was actually one of the people I talked about, who I drank with and had partied with and saw as a train wreck, and she was lit up, and she was, listen, significantly younger than me, and you know, nothing externally in common, but I knew, like, and I just asked her what she was doing, and she was really active in AA now. She didn't stay sober, sadly. She stopped doing the work, but I for the rest of my life, I'll be grateful to that woman and what she did.
Let's see. I'm just going to read the questions. How did you grow your relationship with God at the beginning when it first started?
Well, honestly, I didn't put a lot of effort into growing. I did the work outline in the big book, and I said the prayers that people told me to pray. And when I was told to write an inventory, I wrote, or if I was told to admit I was wrong. And for up until 4 years sober, that's all I was doing, until I got uncomfortable again. And my current sponsor, the woman who sponsors me today, asked me, like, you know, what books are you reading? And like, wow, some novel in the big book. And we ended up talking about what it says in step 11 about how we seek to see where religious people are right, how we continue to read other books. And that's when the journey started on this whole path of, you know, I think one of our founders said that our book is spiritual kindergarten, and what seeking God today looks like is a lot different from what it looks like in the beginning. But I will tell you, my experience was simply taking the action as outlined in the book. I don't know that I understood God, but I experienced the power. I experienced God. I saw things. I felt things that I had never felt before. And one day I look back and I'm like, holy shit, I haven't thought about a drink. Like, what's happening? And I knew that wasn't me. I knew that was God. And that's it. It was that simple.
Thank you. Someone wants to know, how did you deal with being incarcerated? Lack of sleep, adjusting to life, etc.
Depends which time you're talking about. There were many times when I would lie about I'm just being honest. I would lie about psychiatric symptoms to get like extra medication and, you know, or buy medication from other, you know, inmates. I hate being in my sober skin. So, you know, being incarcerated for an alcoholic is one of the most unbearable things you can do. You've stripped me of every solution that I have. I don't have the boyfriends. I don't have the alcohol. I have nothing. You know, the last time around, like I was crippled with fear and I had nothing and I, you know, I was too afraid to do anything else. And like, it was almost like nothing was being given to me. Like I wasn't able to get psych meds. I wasn't able to do anything this last time around. And my mom would send me books and I would do a lot of writing. I caused a lot of damage while incarcerated. Cause like you give me a pen and paper and a couple stamps and I ended up owing a lot of amends just for that alone. So I can't say that I used the time very wisely. I know a lot of people like go through the steps and read different books. That's not my story. I read a lot of trashy. I read 50 Shades of Grey and stuff. Like it was terrible. So, and the evidence is how many people I hurt, you know, because I wasn't doing anything for my spirit during that time.
Did you have any amends that first pass through that didn't seem to go well at first, but turned out to have gone just perfectly?
My niece and my sister, yeah. And and my daughter, because like, honestly, she just hearing, I don't want to hear what you have to say, or like, I don't want to hear words from you. Or my niece who wouldn't even speak to me. I now have an amazing relationship with her. And, you know, it talks in our literature that a long period of reconstruction is ahead. Whereas I have a list of people who just blocked me on Facebook and said, please never contact me again. That did happen. But they were more casual acquaintances to me. When it came to the people I loved, I don't want to say they made me work for it, but it was like, they needed to see a demonstration, and the demonstration had to be over a significant period of time. And it wasn't until, honestly, after my one sister died and a lot of people saw how God carried me through that situation, that relationships became restored that way. But it was, you know, not putting the expectation of an outcome on the amends is an important thing. It's like, and not being devastated when it doesn't seemingly go your way, because the reality is like, we've, you know, for me at least, I know I caused decades of harm. So I can't be expecting of people to just be like, oh, no problem. You know, thanks for this conversation. You know, people want to see action. And for me, like, the real part of the ninth step is the action followed up by the declaration.
Right on. Thank you. Someone wants to know if you have a standard way of taking someone through the steps, i.e. using the big book or the 12 and 12, et cetera.
So I don't look at going through anybody through the steps as a cookie cutter approach, but I always use the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And chapter 7 is a very, very clear cut direction on what to do and what not to do when, you know, and this is all trial and error, by the way. I've made every mistake. I've been the moral spiritual hilltop person. I've been the beating you over the head with a book person. But what I found in the years that I've been sober is that when I trust God and I invite God into my heart and into the room, and you know, cause it's every woman is different. Every experience is different. I have some women I sponsor who know this book cover to cover and can't get a second sober, but they've never actually taken any of the action. So I close the book and we start going over like what work needs to be done. So I do exactly what it says in chapter 7. Get to know your prospect. Get to know the person and then let God lead from there. And I found that you know, that has been the most effective approach, and always do it with love in my heart. I'm not effective unless love is in my heart.
Thank you. Can you share some of your present day 11th step practices?
Ooh, my 11th step practices. Okay, well, there's a lot of books that I love, a lot of authors that I'm truly in love with, like Eckhart Tolle is one of my favorite, Michael Singer, you know, because it does say to seek to see where religious people are right, read other books. And, you know, I struggled honestly with, you know, and I'm just going to share this openly, with Christianity when I first got sober because of my upbringing and the things that I had experienced and being brought up in the church. So I had a lot of prejudices up until 4 years sober that I didn't even know that I was carrying around. And a lot of these authors have helped me understand all religions better, including Christianity, and be open to all of that. So, you know, I meditate. I use guided meditations through different apps and YouTube in the morning and at night. I still use the prayers out of the big book and the disciplines, and I still send out a nightly review. But for me, I've needed to go further with those meditations and do things that, frankly, I found really uncomfortable in the beginning. I was one of those people who was like, well, I can't meditate. I don't know how to shut this brain off. It's just like everything else. It's practice. It takes work. It even says in our book, prayer, if we have the proper attitude and work at it, this is something that does not come easy for us. We need to work at it. And that's been, you know, I would like to, you know, continue on that, just to be open to reading new things and trying new meditations and things like that. So, and I have a lot of people in my life who, we share books, we share authors, we share meditations with each other. So
I caught the phrase, I send out a nightly inventory. What do you mean when you say that?
I send my nightly inventory out of accountability to my sponsor. Like, as I, you know, when we retire at night, it asks us to ask these questions. And, you know, I share that with my sponsor. I send it out to her every night, just their accountability. She usually just ignores it and doesn't say anything, but if there's something on there that's, you know, she might be able to offer insight on, you know, she'll pipe in. But, you know, it's really more for getting in the discipline and the practice of it, because, you know, frankly, I'm a lazy alcoholic, and I would, you know, if I don't have a lot of people holding me accountable, eventually I'll just fall off and stop doing it. So
is that something you do with your sponsees? Is that sort of a common thing in your sponsorship family, or?
Yes. And oftentimes I'll send mine to them as well. Not always, but, you know, if there's like something really sensitive in there. But I also like to share it with the women I sponsor, because it's my firm belief that we go shoulder to shoulder, that there's not some hierarchy here, that they need to know that I'm just as flawed and human as they are. And I share that humanness with all the women I sponsor. And I've become much more effective sponsor when I don't pretend I have my shit together all the time.
Right on. All right, now we're getting somewhere. We're getting some good questions now. Thank you guys for sending them in. This one is the reason why we're here. The question reads, I am in early sobriety and I feel like I'm crawling out of my skin. There just aren't enough meetings to occupy my time. What can I do?
Welcome, first of all, welcome whoever you are. And I totally understand what you feel like. And frankly, when I remember years and years of trying this, looking for everything outside to occupy my time, because I've got a head that wakes me up every morning, annihilating me. And when I'm in bed at night trying to go to sleep, I'm thinking of all the horrible things that I've done, and it won't let me sleep. So it seems like there's this like endless hours of the day. So I totally understand what you're going through. But here's the beautiful thing, and getting a sponsor and going through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, when I started to do this, not only does it give you something to do, because there's work involved, especially when it comes to writing inventory, it's like homework assignments, right? So in those times where you feel like you have all this, you know, time in the day, you have plenty of time to write an inventory, right? Like, and so what starts to happen is, when I'm not holding on to it, when I'm doing what it says to, like, face and be rid of it. It's not even a dramatic experience. Everybody built a fourth step out to be this, like, oh my God, I have to share this terrible stuff. If you read how they write it in the big book, it's like, listen, we're here to discover the truth of the stock and trade. We're, you know, we're going to just look at this stuff. We're going to get rid of it promptly and without regret. There's no drama in this. We create the drama. It's stuff we've all done. And when you start doing this, not only will those hours in the day start to pass, that spirit of yours is going to feel so much lighter because you're carrying around all this stuff that you don't need to carry anymore. And then the really beautiful thing is that woman you're sitting with is going to say, you know what, me too. And then you're not going to feel alone anymore. I promise you. So get a sponsor and take the 12 steps.
Thank you. How long before the obsession to drink was lifted, and has it ever returned for you?
So the obsession, I don't have an exact date. I remember it was a strange moment that I guess it would have been in about 9 months that I had after I'd gone. No, not even. I think it had been 4 months after going through my steps. I was made recovery house manager, and a girl came home from the hospital, and she had an open heart surgery. So she was allowed to have a specific narcotic, and I was assigned to help lock up the medication and count it out to make sure the pill count was correct. And it was interesting. I was counting it out, and I put it away, and I walked away, and I just said, holy shit, I didn't once think about like pocketing that. And I knew, like, that was so surreal to me. And that was about, and so it wasn't this moment where I just like, oh, poof, it was gone. It was like something I look back. And then I was like, I can't remember the last time I thought about this. And as far as it returning, I had one moment. I experienced a pretty bad trauma over the winter, and it wasn't an obsession. It was a weird thought. This is AA, so I'm going to be real careful with what I say, but I had surgery, and I was very honest with them before going to surgery, and I told them, like, hey, here's the deal. Like, I don't want to go home with anything, because of my history. And I was in a lot of pain after the surgery, and the nurse called me and said, hey, are you taking these specific drugs that the doctor gave you? And they weren't the drugs I was prescribed. So my head immediately said, like I had a thought in my head, oh, why did I tell the truth? And I immediately called my sponsor and I told her, like, why did I have that thought? She's like, of course you had that thought. But it wasn't an obsession. So it was just a reminder that my alcoholism, I'm never cured of this. Like, I have an insane part of my brain when it comes to these sorts of things, but it never turned into an obsession. I didn't spend the rest of my day thinking about it, but I have an abnormal mind as well as an abnormal body when it comes to alcohol and other substances that I must be mindful of for the rest of my life.
Thank you. How do you know when you're ready to sponsor others?
Oh, my sponsor didn't give me a choice. So, she didn't. She told me when I had made a few amends, she told me I needed to start raising my hand at meetings and telling women, that I was available to sponsor. And, I was like, I'm going to screw this up. I have nothing to offer. And, of course I kept going through my steps and nobody asked me until I was through all 12 steps. But, pretty much like when my sponsor told me, I started raising my hand and started telling, because my ego wants to tell me that it's that I'm doing anything. It's not me anyway. Like I have a woman I've sponsored. She is, she's my proof that it's not me, that it's God. I sponsored her for 4 years now. I took her through the steps 3 times, same way, didn't change anything up a single time. She did not stay sober the first 2 times. She did the 3rd time. Has nothing to do with me. I just show up in the book and invite God in, and that's it.
How has your relationship with your sponsor and or your sponsees changed over this last year during pandemic? How have you had to adjust or if you had to adjust?
Well, of course, we all had to be comfortable, doing this kind of stuff and communicating electronically. I actually got really close with my sponsor. I called her up, because like everybody else, all of my external stuff, I was working, but I had to work from home, and my relationship started to tank. I had all this stuff being stripped from me again, and I didn't realize how human reliant I'd become. So I call my sponsor and I tell her, I think I need to do another inventory. And she's like, well, I think, why don't you just go? She said she'd gone through the steps again And she said, I think I'm going to take you through again in this way that she had just gone through a very intense way with, and so we had that experience together going through the steps again. And with the women I sponsor, like we ended up getting really close because I'll tell you, everybody came crazy willing to do work when we were all sitting at home completely insane. So, and I know that wasn't the case for everybody. I know we had a lot of other people who just sort of fell off the mat, but it's funny how many of the women I was sponsoring who were just kind of dragging their feet on certain work, all of a sudden became really willing to do it when they had, you know, 18 hours a day in their life with nothing else to do with it.
Somebody would like a suggestion on a meditation app that you might recommend.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's called Insight Timer. Check it out. It's wonderful.
You listen to the Audio Dharma stuff?
Audio Dharma.
Audio Dharma is a podcast from the same group of people that put out Insight Timer.
Oh, I'll check it out.
Yeah, yeah. So that's all my, I got one more question left. So I'm going to offer a last call. If you got a burning desire, get your question in there. But we're down to our last. And I wonder if you might share a little bit about what being a member of the home group has meant to you.
Well, it depends on the home. No, my first home group, I felt part of something for the first time in my entire life. And I got really excited about Alcoholics Anonymous and about being in the center of feeling included and belonging and being able to feel purpose, because I never felt that before, like showing up and also having a home group and a commitment, having a service commitment at all times throughout my sobriety, has always kept me in like the times where things have gotten really rough, like say my relationship was falling apart, right? Or something wasn't great at home. It's like, well, I have the Sunday night candlelight meeting. I have to go. I have to show up. I can't let people down. Kept me accountable at times where I might otherwise not have shown up. So it gave me like this family and friends like that I have to this day that mean the world to me. It also, you know, I've had to change it because I was at a clubhouse and, you know, I got, my ego got too heavily involved in it. But the beautiful thing about changing home groups is it allowed me to grow. Not that I outgrew one home group, but it was like I led to grow and experience new relationships with new people and expand my horizons and expand, you know, like my life. Like I lived a really small life before coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, a real little small life. And the connections I get to make today, it's such a gift. It's such a gift because, listen, you know, we all thought we had friends, or at least I know I thought I had friends before I came into AA, maybe not towards the very end, but not one of those people were concerned with what I was doing when I finally got sober or ended up in prison. You know, I wasn't exactly getting a ton of mail from people that weren't family, that didn't have the same last name. But what happens with a home group is, you know, it's a weekly place where you see these people and you form these relationships, and maybe your personalities might not always mesh, but you get to know one another and you get to connect and you get to form bonds with people that you don't have anywhere else. And when, you know, I remember when my sister died, I was surrounded by more people than like I had to put up a post on Facebook saying, I love you all and I'll get back to you later, because I couldn't respond to the outpouring of love. And like, I didn't have that before AA. And I believe that is part, that's what happens with the home group. And, you know, because that's where people get to know you.
My ears did kind of, when you were telling your story, I wanted to circle back and I forgot. Do you want to tell that I having to make amends story to your old home group?
Sure. So I started to get really involved in the traditions, and it's funny, this is how God uses my defects, right? I didn't agree with something that was going on in my home group. And so I went and through these traditions and I learned everything I could possibly learn about them just so I could argue effectively in my home group. This is just sharing with you the level of how sick I can still be and how bad my ego can get. What I felt was like, directly contradictory to several of our traditions, and I brought it to the group, and they did not agree with me, and they went their way, and instead of just accepting the tradition that says our group is, you know, there's but one ultimate authority, I felt the need to, like, and you know, argue and continue to argue about it and allow my ego to cause division between me and multiple members of the, there's a board of directors because it's a clubhouse and that service structure is different. And I was on that board of directors for several years. And, you know, I forget sometimes that this service structure in AA is an upside down triangle. The higher up we think we are on the scale is like we're lower, we're serving from the bottom. And that that's all I am is a trusted servant. I used my voice. I said what I needed to say. The group voted otherwise and I didn't accept it. And as a direct result of that, I hurt people. And I had to go, you know, back humbly through the list of people that I argued with and tried to, you know, beat my own ideas down their throat and make that right. And I'm really glad I did because now, you know, I don't carry that anymore.
Yeah. Now you can walk back into that meeting.
Absolutely.
Right on. Oh, thank you so much. This is going to bring us to the end. You were so generous with your time. Let's see. I'll give everybody will have the opportunity to thank Sarah again after the Lord's Prayer. And I wonder if I could prevail upon our dear Debbie. Let me see if I can share my screen here to read the last two paragraphs on page 164. Let's see. Apparently they upgraded Zoom and all I can do is share my screen, which means I'm going to share everything I'm looking at, I think. Can you see that?
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Deb. Oh, did I not give permission to unmute? Give me another year of Zooming. I'll get it right.
Okay, I have a book.
This is a test.
For just this purpose, I have a book. I'm an alcoholic, my name is Debbie.
Hi, Debbie.
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thanks.
Thank you, Debbie. Thank everybody for a wonderful meeting, for Larry, for wrangling the questions, and for all of you for coming out on this lovely holiday Sunday. Perhaps we could virtually circle up and virtually hold hands and invite everybody to unmute. Let's have a confusing Lord's Prayer closer. Moment of silence to do with as you wish, followed by the Lord's Prayer.
Sorry for the delay. It is taking more than usual.
Our Father.
Our Father,
hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come,
thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven.
Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses
as we forgive those who trespass
against us, and lead us not into
temptation, but deliver us from evil. But thine is the kingdom. And the power and the glory forever and ever. Amen.
Coming back, it works when you work it.
Yes, it did.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you
so much, Sarah.
Thank you for a great meeting. God bless you, Sarah.
Thanks, Sarah. That was awesome.
Yeah, that was the best. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
My heart. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Great fire, baby.
Fire.
Yeah. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you. Thank you so much.